You're listening to Save My City, part of the We Love Where You Live podcast series brought to you by the Michigan Municipal League. Here's your host, Tony Mangini.
Hi, and thanks for joining us for the Save My City podcast. Today we have a whole panel of guests here today. We're joined again by Steve Duchesne. Steve's the founder of the Taxpayers for Michigan Constitutional Government. It's such a mouthful. I love saying that every time. Rolls right off the tongue. And then we have Professor John Moak, who is a professor of law with Wayne State University, and my colleague and lead counsel for the league, Bill Matheson. So we're going to talk again. Steve was on just a few weeks ago, and we talked about this case that they've brought, the Taxpayers for Michigan Constitutional Government brought against the state of Michigan, talking about issues relating to the Headley Amendment. And so I thought it might be helpful maybe if we just start off by remind folks what that's all about.
Well, I was just contemplating the fact that the dating of this case probably goes back. My career in public management in Michigan goes back to a few years just before Headley was originally passed. And I think the Municipal League and many of us have worked with the interpretation of the Headley Amendment and how it applies municipal finance and funding and how it applied to our relationship with the state, obviously since 78. And here we are still talking about it today. Where we are certainly now and why we formed this nonprofit group, and my co-founder John Moak and I felt it was a good time to act, was somewhat the precedent was really started to be sent when the Save My City and that whole, I guess it's always been on our minds. I mean, when there you go to a conference topic for the Michigan Municipal League, finance is critical. But I think as we've all known that with the Proposal A, the advent of Proposal A in the mid-90s, our financial system, the carefully balanced design system, has been sorely affected. And then on top of it, the legislative interpretation, and in this case, the interpretation of the calculations by the Department of Technology Management and Budget have left local municipal services as the one taking the brunt of the reduction in financing in this state, which brought us to, as my good friend and Professor Moak said, why don't you do something about it? And I said, well, we all have been for decades, but it didn't look like we were making a lot of progress in some cases trying to influence the legislature. So that's what was really kind of prompted this action.
So he double dog dared you to do something.
I think that was about it, right over the soup and the salad at Olive Garden. I mean, you can't back away from a challenge when it comes out there. So
Tony, let me speak to the case itself. The case was commenced in September 2016, and it's based upon the state's violation of the Headley Amendment and the requirement that the state share 48.97% of state revenue with local governments. The Headley Amendment was passed in 1978, and the percentage was originally set at 41.6%. But then in 1989, Oakland County challenged the state with respect to mental health payments that were being made to counties to provide mental health services for the state. And Oakland County took the position that those payments could not be counted as part of the 41.6% because they were payments to carry out a state obligation and not payments in the form of aid to help local units of government. And the Court of Appeals agreed with that and basically said, well, rather than reducing the payments percentage, we'll increase the percentage to 48.97% and allow the amount the state is including for mental health payments to be kept in the percentage. And so there was this increase to 48.97% where it stands today.
So let's just rewind for just a quick second. So just folks understand, this percentage you're talking about was part of when they passed the Headley Amendment, setting a minimum threshold for local government funding as part of the overall state budget.
Correct. The Headley Amendment does two things. It limits the ability of local governments to raise taxes, but it also requires the state to continue sharing its state revenue with local governments in the same percentage that it shared with local governments in 1978 when the amendment was adopted. And that percentage of state revenue each year that's supposed to be shared with local governments is 48.97%. And each year, the Department of Technology Management and Budget and the Auditor General certify to the legislature and to the public that that percentage is being met. And what this case is about is that there is, our viewpoint is that there are other payments that are being included, such as the Oakland County health payment, mental health payment was included. There are other payments that are being included in that percentage that are not eligible to be included. And therefore, because those payments are being included, local governments are not receiving 48.97% of the state revenue they should.
And we're not talking about just a few dollars here. I mean, there's a significant amount of money, according to the points of the case, that are being diverted. We're talking about billions of dollars.
The case has three claims. One is that the Prop A funding is not eligible to be included. The second is that payments made by the state to charter schools that are nonprofit corporations and not local governments is not included, entitled to be included. And the third claim is that payments made under the Headley Amendment to local governments for mandates imposed on local governments, which local governments are required to carry out and the state is required to fund, those funded payments are not payments in the form of aid, and therefore and are being counted, and so they have to be excluded as well. Now, altogether, that would exceed $5 billion annually.
We can do something with $5 billion.
I think so. When you certainly see, and if you manage cities or been an official for them for any length of time in Michigan, we see the degradation of revenue sharing as a one component of our base. And a little bit of a history lesson for those who wonder how we got there is Michigan always was set up on a basis of state collected, locally shared revenues, because we've been, as local governments, restricted in the types of revenue that we can generate. The state collects it, sales taxes, and shares it with the community. So this is very critical. It really goes back to the very fabric of what the people approved in their constitution in Michigan. We're a home rule state. We believe in local government control. And we have a situation where most of our systems were put in place for the state to act as a practical functionary, collecting revenue, but then distributing it to the communities. Here, we've been left with constraints on our largest revenue source, which is property taxes, and either strict limits on what other revenue can be raised, and then a formula, though, derived from the state that has limited or reduced that revenue that we really can't make any changes in. We can't come up with alternatives for revenue. So we've been basically for several decades now, we're kind of cutting, we're cutting to inadequacy in a lot of our cities. And the state they need to look at emergency managers and conditions in the cities, as the state policy has directly created those situations.
Well, I think the last recession really drove that point home very hard, that the system we've designed, you actually used the phrase carefully designed system, and I tried not to spit water out at you, but the reality is the system doesn't work, and it's creating a lot of these problems, and the recession's brought that all in. Illuminated it very brightly. Professor Moak brought up three different sort of points on this. Maybe we'll start in reverse. One, you talked about unfunded mandates. So when the Headley Amendment passed, it basically said in layman's terms, if the state requires local government to do something that they're not being asked to do today, the state's got to pay for that, right? Is that
correct?
In a nutshell?
Correct.
So what you're saying is, if I understand correctly, currently the state counts those payments as meeting this minimal funding, when clearly, as I understood it, that was sort of outside of that. That was an add-on.
Right. The extent that the state makes the payments for the mandated services required by a local government or by local governments, they count those payments as part of the 48.97% requirement to be shared with local governments. And the position in the lawsuit is you can't count those payments because they're not payments in the form of aid to local governments to allow local governments to carry out their own services. They are payments that to reimburse for mandated services by the state.
That makes sense. I mean, it's like you said, if we're going to add that in, it sort of seems to, self-defeating in interpretation of doing
well,
it
Well, let's
way.
Take it to its extreme. If they mandated enough services and they counted them, there would be no revenue sharing. They could take up the entire 48.97%. That's not the case currently, but logically, that would make no sense in terms of the Headley Amendment itself requiring the sharing of state revenue with local governments.
Do we have an idea of how much of the $5 billion that you said was out there, how much this makes up?
No, it's probably less than $1 billion. And one of the problems is that there is not full disclosure on the amount of payments that are being made statewide for these mandates. And so assuming we're successful in our case, we'll ask that the state provide to the court and to us the amount that's being paid and included in the percentage.
That has been something I've been surprised at. Observing from afar the work that you guys have been doing is the lack of good data around some of this stuff. It's been pretty interesting to watch.
I think especially as a practitioner for four decades, when the state would require us to file, you know, a form about forms and the detail and the data they want to support it, and then have our legal team seek to just, you know, find
Can
answers
we get back what
to
we gave
simple
you?
Questions. Yeah, they and to have our state auditor basically say in a report, we're kind of like that commercial where the guard is standing in a bank, he's monitoring things, he's not really guarding, I'm just here as a monitor. And that's the impression I've said this to many of our local official friends. I've said, I think your state auditor gives a letter every year saying, yeah, there was a pile of books and data over here, we looked at it we touched it. It's real, so good luck. Mm. I mean, we had some frustrations, and I was extremely frustrated on a couple of our issues. These our folks, our legal team and research team is working so hard to try to, you know, find some basic information, and the state just, they don't look at it that way, they don't provide it that way, which also means they don't look at data when they're making a decision. I think that doesn't come as a shock to anybody at the table, and I'm sure none of our listeners will be shocked.
I find it interesting. They can tell you they're meeting the requirement, but when we ask them how, they don't have the data to support how they did it.
That's well put.
I think my wife uses that system for managing the house.
I want to share one quick recent example. If people think that we're talking history, we had this issue come up, and I know there's a political sensitivity about veterans exemptions. But to me, it illustrated, and I use it as a teaching point about how a state changes policy without thinking about the effects. And I know we've had some good consideration from representatives to change this. But your state legislatures decided they would increase and change exemption requirements for veterans on property taxes. Fine, that's well and good. As a state policy, may they want to do that. However, it wasn't their money. They don't collect it and they don't use it. It was property taxes. So the state, and I say this very simply, they're like the guy at the bar that says round of drinks for everybody and then walks out of the bar and lets somebody else pay for it. And that's really what is encapsulated, I think, in our very short-term memories of the legislature. They don't sometimes understand how the process works. They just gave away local government's money for themselves to look good. They mandated that, a different method of exemption on properties, but they had no clear purpose. They weren't going to fund it. They weren't going to take it from state coffers. Mm-hmm. It was all from your money and local taxpayers.
Yeah, that's the continuing battle for sure. Continue to rewind. The second point you talked about was this idea of they're counting payments to charter schools as part of this funding for local government. That's something I never really thought about, but the first time I heard it explained, I must admit, really got my attention. That's quite an intriguing way of looking at it. And as you explain it, or at least explain to me, it makes sense what you're saying. So can you explain a little bit more about the argument around why that shouldn't count?
The Headley Amendment requires the state to make this percentage payment, 48.97%, to local governments. And Section 33 of the Headley Amendment defines local governments. And the definition of local government is a political subdivision of the state. When in 1994, when the Public School Academies Act was passed creating charter schools, and payments began to be made as charter schools spread across the state deemed charter schools to be local governments and political subdivisions of the state. But whether or not charter schools are local governments depends upon the meaning of the term as commonly understood by the electorate when they adopted the Headley Amendment in 1978. And our position is the meaning of the term local government is not a private corporation, which the Public School Academies Act requires be created. It's not a private corporation with a private board of directors. It is a governmental entity that has sovereign powers. It's controlled by the electorate, and it has defined geographic boundaries, as that would have been understood in 1978. And the charter schools contain meet none of those criteria, and they're not local governments. And while the state may establish and fund charter schools as public school districts, they are not public school districts that are local governments, and therefore our position is that the funding of charter schools cannot be included in the percentage, which it is now being included.
Mm-hmm. As my mind continues to churn these things, I even wonder sometimes if the entire thing is legal. When you sort of step back and think about a lending of credits issue, they're not paying a payment for services rendered, right? They're giving them money. It's a really interesting argument I ever thought about. I think there's a lot of spokes on that wheel that if someone continues to dig into that, it might be interesting. The first thing you talked about, you said the Prop A stuff, and you sort of threw that out there. What did you mean when you said that?
Well, in 1993, the legislature determined that there needed to be a restructuring of the finance of public schools. And so what they did was they abolished the authority of local school districts to tax local taxpayers to support their educational programs in the local school districts. By abolishing that taxing authority of the local school districts, they essentially abolished $6.5 billion in revenue from local taxpayers that were supporting the local schools. And the legislature then in 1993 could not come up with an alternative approach for finance to fill the hole. So they put a proposal on the ballot, Proposal A, for the voters to approve and to amend the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And Proposal A basically increases the state sales tax by 2%, from 4% to 6%. And it adds a few other taxes that basically the local taxpayers pay to the state rather than paying the property tax to their local district. So the local property taxpayers pay these taxes to the state, roughly equivalent to what they were paying to local school districts. And the state collects the money and then transfers the money down to the local school districts. When that transfer is made, they count that payment to the local school districts as part of the percentage. So that basically means that taxpayers, when they count it as part of the percentage, they then reduce the amount of other state revenue that was being paid to municipalities, counties, townships, villages, gets reduced by that amount.
So
what has occurred is a tax shift, and it's placing a tax burden on local governments and their taxpayers because state revenue previously shared with those governments is now not shared with those governments, so the governments have to reduce their service or increase taxes on their local taxpayers. And so Section 25 of the Headley Amendment plays into this. It basically prohibits the state from placing a tax burden on local governments. And what we maintain in the lawsuit is that when Proposal A funding is counted in the percentage, it's placing a tax burden on local governments and therefore may not be counted.
You know, when I thought about it in just sort of layperson's terms, it seems to me they changed half the math problem. They had this influx created by the additional 2 cents of sales tax, and we're going to count it in this part of the math problem, but not in the bottom part. So now it's like, wow, look at this. We're really overfunded now. Mm-hmm. We're doing a great job. But what they failed to realize, what they didn't change was the other half of the math problem. And so that to me in and of itself seems like
let me put it to you this way. You know, in my view and the view of many people, restructuring school financing so you can level the playing field among school districts and not enrich districts don't necessarily, for their children, have a great advantage over poorer districts. That's a good idea. Okay. So, but that's not part of this lawsuit. We're not opposed to restructuring financing. What's going on here is, assume for the moment that somebody at the state level said, okay, let's restructure financing as Proposal A does. And what that'll allow us to do is level the playing field, but we can keep $3 billion and use it for our own state purposes by counting the money and reducing state revenue we normally send to the local governments. We're going to do this as part of a single scheme to restructure school financing and keep $3 billion for our own use. And there's no doubt in my mind that that would be a clear violation of the Headley Amendment. But the Headley Amendment does not relate to intent, it's impact. And whether it's intended to be done that way or whether it's done that way and there's an impact, in our view, makes no difference. This money is not entitled to be counted.
I don't disagree. And I mean, you know, we've seen the impact it's had on local government, and it's been devastating. And the fact of the matter remains is whether that was some secret meeting where they laid that plan out or that happened by coincidence is sort of irrelevant. The reality is those impacts have been real.
Tony, may I add to it that the other part of it we talked, and when you, it reminded me when you said half the equation, one of the other things that certainly happens is this is pushed onto back to the local communities to raise their own revenues, and yet the devices to control property tax have all been laid on local governments without relief. So in part, when the state says to a local government entity, says it seems like you're raising taxes on your people and you're increasing property tax, where we can, we're limited by the constitutional requirements, but also by other methods, we sometimes get creative and raise taxes, and then they say, well, that doesn't seem to be right. You're creating, why do you have these high local taxes? Well, actually, as John said, it's really just they took the $3 billion for state purposes and left us with a void to fill, so your local communities have to find another way to fund their services for real boots-on-the-ground services, not esoteric, whatever the state of Michigan thinks is a good idea today kinds of services. So it has that double hit. You know, we take half your money away and then say, well, geez, you guys got to, you know, you're raising fees on people a lot. That's really too bad.
Well, and I'll tell you, there's a lot of gray hair on this table. So we're around pre-Prop A, and so we know how this worked. And the system of funding local government in Michigan worked. We had appropriate revenues. We were able to provide the services that we needed. And we felt the ups and downs of the economy, all these things worked. And post-Prop A, we've taken away so many of these things, whether it's the diversion of the money, the lack of upward mobility. There's been a number of things created by the implementation of this stuff. So it's kind of amazing that it took this recession, really, I think, to really energize folks to go and take this stuff on. But I'm glad that we're finally getting to a place where we're sort of having some really difficult conversation. And it's a very complicated issue, for sure. Bill, you've been quiet so far, but recently, the Legal Defense Fund of the League made a decision to engage in the case. You want to talk about the involvement of the LDF and what we're doing and why we're doing it?
Sure. Thank you. The Legal Defense Fund is a part of the Michigan Municipal League, and it is a voluntary group among the members of the league. And the concept of the Legal Defense Fund is that if a case is brought to us from a community, and it is a case that would have statewide impact, it would be something that would affect all cities and villages in Michigan, then our Legal Defense Fund takes a look at it and tries to assess the importance of it and whether or not, on behalf of the league, it wants to become involved. And we worked with Professor Moak for some period of time, and he brought us up to speed on the elements of the case. And actually, Tony, as you know, the league's trustees had a special committee that looked at these issues for about a year and a half, mm-hmm. I believe. So it was a considerable amount of time and a lot of thought went into it. Ultimately, the Legal Defense Fund decided that this is the sort of case that has really far-reaching impact and is fundamentally important to the financing of municipal government in Michigan. So it made the decision to retain Dennis Pollard at Secrets Wardell as our amicus counsel, and he prepared an amicus brief that has been filed with the court. And importantly, we at the Municipal League were joined by the Michigan Townships Association, the Michigan Association of Counties, and the Government Law Section of the State Bar of Michigan. So all four of these groups have filed the amicus brief with the court, and amicus just means friend of the court, literally.
You read my mind. I was going to say, can you explain what that is?
Yeah. So it just means friend of the court, literally. But the point is that we were permitted by the court. We were challenged by the state in the ability to do this. But ultimately, the court correctly decided that we should be allowed to file this amicus brief. And what we can bring to the case is to give a little bit, more practical, I think, in addition to the legal arguments that that the main brief has posed, and some of the impact, the actual impact to the municipalities, all the local governments that are affected by the case.
Didn't we retain a group to take a look at the actual economics of some of this?
Right. We have, and actually our amicus counsel worked closely with Mitch Bean and Robert Klein, both of whom have a tremendous background in state finances as state officials for quite a number of years. And they have been doing a lot of research into the impact of state funding on cities, villages, townships, and counties. And it was based on those data that a large part of the amicus brief was developed.
Yeah, I mean, the impacts have been significant. And I know Mitch used to run the, he was the House Fiscal Agency Director,
right.
And Bob Klein was a former state treasurer. So these
right.
are folks that clearly understand these issues on a whole different level, and as well as how it works from the state side, which has been sort of the missing piece of some of this stuff. So I think their insights are really critical in trying to make sense out of all this stuff.
In fact, their insights are very valuable because we found out early days of the doing the groundwork on the litigation. For those people out there who are municipal finance people or others, you would think you would go to the drawer marked calculations for, you know, the meeting the requirements under Headley, and you'd pull out the sheet and you'd say, well, here's how we did it. That doesn't appear the way that the state of Michigan has operated. We don't have that manila folder filled with the calculations like they require us to do. Like under truth and taxation, we have to show our math, show our work. Our people found a terrible struggle. So we need that state insight to really rebuild things or to build them from the ground up, because they aren't readily available. I'm not saying that was done intentionally, but it was useful if you happen to be a defendant in a lawsuit.
Mm. Well, it was very convenient, at least.
Yeah.
The involvement of the league through the defense fund and its partners are, in my view, are important to this case, because the plaintiffs are taxpayers, and we're speaking from the point of view of taxpayers and the burdens that their governments are experiencing, and then they are feeling as a result. And the amicus brief basically directly expresses the local government's own situation and concern. So it's a separate voice. And it's an important voice to have in the case.
Well, and I your insights in that regard, I think, are important. I go all over the place giving speeches on this stuff, and I always talk about this idea that we're diverting money away from local government to fund state bureaucracy, and, you know, it's a nice soundbite and everything. But the reality is, that's exactly what's happening, and that's what mm-hmm. this case is all about. Is you're wondering why your local roads aren't being fixed. You're wondering why you're not seeing a higher level of local services or pension issues, all these different things we're dealing with. The reality is, because we've lost billions and billions of dollars over the last 20 years, it's having a major impact. In this case, what I find amazing is it's taken this long for this case to get to this level. I'll be honest with you. When you first started hearing you guys were doing this, my gut level reaction was, how can we even do this at this point, you know, in the game? And, you know, God, there can't be any argument stuff we haven't talked about. And you guys have put together, I think, a pretty impressive set of arguments that really lays this out in a pretty simple way. You know, I mean, it's like, it's complicated, but at the same time, the root arguments are pretty straightforward. Money should have been X, it wasn't. Money should have went here, it didn't. And working down that, and I know the state tried to, you know, file a couple of motions to get out of this, which didn't happen. And I find it interesting that this continues to move forward in a pretty expeditious way. So where are you now in terms of the court, and what should we expect next? Where are we going with this?
At this point, the the plaintiffs, the taxpayers, have filed a motion for summary judgment, and the state has filed a motion to dismiss our case, which then sets up the determination by the court on the merits. We've each answered the other's initial filing, and then we've each replied to the other's answer. So they have three separate filings on each side that are now before the court. And the amicus brief is in. Basically, unless something unexpected occurs, all of the written filings are presented now to the court. The court has to decide whether or not to hold a hearing.
And this is the Court of Appeals, right?
Court of Appeals.
Okay.
The Headley Amendment requires that the case be filed in the Court of Appeals. So the court has to decide whether it will hold a hearing. And both sides have requested a hearing. The court does not have to hold a hearing. The court can simply decide the case on what the materials that have been submitted. So we're waiting to see whether a hearing will be held. If one isn't held, we would expect a decision in the next 30 to 60 days. If a hearing is held, we would expect a hearing within the next 30 to 45 days. And then thereafter, another 30, 45 days for a decision. So sometime in the spring, we're either going to have a hearing or we're going to get a decision out of the Court of Appeals.
Interesting.
And I want to say that to our contributing members, the municipalities that ponied up, and while going out and talking to them, and they sent contributory checks to us to support our efforts of $1,500 each, many of them said, and I thank them, because many mayors, managers, council people said, well, we know we probably won't hear about this for 7 years, but it's worthy of the try. I think that's been a surprise to them, and a very pleasant one, obviously, that whatever is going to happen is a shorter term. I know in the case involving school funding years ago, that did take about 7 years. And a lot of these municipal officials said it may not even be me, but I think this is the right thing to do. So I don't use that as a plug for more money, but we do accept checks. we will continue to do so and put it to the good work. Everybody else, and I want to say I want to thank very much Sugar Law Center, supportive legal team, people like Tracy Peters, Sarah Kendall, people who are working for free, that are doing, nobody's making any money off of this. As a plaintiff taxpayer, this, the only hope we see out of this is to do things right.
Let's just talk about this for a second, because that was a nice plug, by the way. It's almost like one of those Academy Award speeches where you thank everybody. But all kidding aside, I mean, this is not being backed by big money. I mean, you have assembled a small group of governments who have ponied up a few dollars to try and help sustain this. The Sugar Law Center stepping up to provide counsel on this. Your work, Professor Moak, has been tremendous. So this is not a big money effort. This is truly folks saying this is wrong. We don't think this is being interpreted right. It's really impacting all of our local governments, our schools, our cities, our counties. And we got to get back to what we agreed to. As voters, this was an amendment that was passed. Everyone had expectations of how it should work. And we're not doing that. And I think that should not be lost in the overarching, conversation around this stuff. It's easy to sort of say, well, the cities want more money or they want this. The reality is this was actually two constitutional amendments. And the argument is we're not interpreting those correctly. And so there's the sort of the rule of law in terms of we need to interpret it correctly. And we're seeing it manifest itself in a very real and direct way in our local governments. And I think that's really what we got to focus on. And if there are more communities, because this does affect literally every community in the state that can and want to participate, they can certainly reach out and continue to do this.
Fair? That's absolutely true. Counties, townships, villages, and cities are all, subject to these the effects, and they can participate and support us. I think the surprise of some is that the state has, and I'll put this in certainly a non-legal viewpoint in plain language, when I've seen some of their responses, and these gentlemen, learned attorneys, men of the law, may categorize it otherwise, I thought some of their responses were preposterous. They basically said, close enough, as if we were playing some kind of, we were dropping a bomb. So, well, that may not exact, but you know what people meant. And no, it's either what the Constitution says and how it's to be done or not. We have to get back to playing the game by the rules. If you want to change rules, you have to know where the rules are. I mean, we can't wait for New York with a bad replay to keep saying, well, that's close enough. We'll be close enough. No, it's the rule. And that's why I think that this has been a very moving action to, as you said, and you articulate very well, if that's what the people voted on, that's what we are to follow. You make a change, propose it to people later, want to run your communities differently, that's fine. But you can't do it a little bit behind the back, sneaky tactics, and hope that it's close enough.
Well, we're not talking about a rounding error, right? We're not saying, nope. Well, we're off by we're not off by $172,000 here.
Tony, so. Let me speak to the modest amount of funding that has been raised, for which we greatly appreciate it. It goes to out-of-pocket costs. It goes to the cost of depositions, discovery, hiring expert witnesses, and court filing costs. So there has been money spent, but it hasn't. None of it's been spent for professional legal services.
That's good to know.
Well, to Steve's point, and Professor Moak can be much more articulate than I, but
we know that. But go on.
But was the Headley Amendment in effect a bargain, and local governments would restrain their spending, which they have done, and the state government, their part of the bargain was that they would not reduce the percentage of funding that had been provided to local governments. I mean, wasn't that the bargain?
That's
wasn't
the
that
bargain,
the understanding
yes.
that the voters accepted? Local governments, you're going to hold back in spending. State government, you're not going to make it worse for them by reducing your percentage. And I think that common sense bargain that people accepted in voting for the Headley Amendment has been violated.
Well, that's exactly right. The way we describe it in the lawsuit is the Headley Amendment sets up a balanced fiscal framework for local governments. It causes them to limit their increase in taxes, but assures that the state will continue to support them at the levels that existed.
Well, you're 100% right. And that's the part, too, that I think it's always important to remind people of. Some people, I think, hear this as, oh, you're trying to get rid of Headley. That's not the case. And I've said this literally hundreds of times. The intent of Headley was good. The intent of Prop A was good. What's messed it up is the implementation, right? I mean, the idea that we want to put controls on growth and taxes and revenues all makes sense. And done properly should happen. But what we've done is not follow what was set out. We got to go back and get back on track in the way we're doing that.
Well, Professor Moak, can you speak to what Richard Headley said in regard to Prop A? Because I think he foresaw the difficulty.
Yeah, when Prop A was put on the ballot, Richard Headley basically is reported to have said that constituted a tax shift that will place a tax burden on local governments and essentially would undermine the Headley framework.
I couldn't be more right on point.
Very
you know,
succinct,
we,
yeah.
We're here through the sales of the Headley Amendment, and if Richard Headley himself, as John and Bill just pointed out, if that was his take on Prop A, I think we have to give some credence to that, because of all the people that wanted to see a different tax, balanced tax system, it was Richard Headley. So we are not attacking the Headley Amendment, even though we would never get anybody to recognize it by its true legal name. I think what it does point out, too, that in what's maybe a heads up for the state leaders and local leaders, but especially state leaders, is we have no concurrency of policy in this state. We do patchwork, fill in what we can get passed in the legislature, raising taxes, changing fees, doing things. We came along and personal property was being, you know, it's going to be eliminated from local revenue, and we're going to create a new beast that we still don't know what it is. We have a creature of the law that's some kind of state local authority that collects personal property, and we've done that since Proposal A. Proposal A itself was one of these unknown new policies that come along, but nobody ever goes back and says, are these things, do they function concurrently? Do they enhance? Do they enable the other to still function? Or does something need to be overall need to be changed to integrate all these things? And unfortunately, we just don't seem to be able to learn that lesson in this state, and resulting in this kind of confusion. The balance framework has definitely been tilted. And when sometimes I think it tilts in a variety of degrees and in different ways. It's not just one way.
Yeah, our position on Proposal A is that Proposal A, of course, is a part of the state constitution and can be implemented. I mean, and is being implemented. The problem that it is presented is when Department of Technology Management and Budget then counts the Proposal A money as part of the percentage. It's that administrative calculation that's that violates the prohibition against shifting the tax burden to local governments.
I agree with you. And unfortunately, like I said, we're probably counting our fingers, all the people that get into the numbers far enough to understand that that's happening. But you're absolutely right. And it doesn't make sense. And it's not what was conceived of when that was done. The more you get involved with this, the more you look at this, you realize just sort of how thoughtful Mr. Headley was in the way he constructed this. When it first happened, it was all this big tax limits and everyone was sort of, you know, panicking in the streets. The reality was he was very thoughtful about how this was constructed and almost in anticipation of what we face now. And really, I think this case really shines a bright light on that.
Well, and as Section 25 of the Constitution says, the state is prohibited from reducing the proportion of state spending in the form of aid to local governments. I mean, this is very, very complicated, but those are the words.
That seems very clear. I think the tax limitations for those of us who were involved in paying attention then, the problem was that to most people, at least it was framed as that property taxes were growing at an exponential rapid rate beyond. People were being taxed out of the homes. They wanted to solve it. There were numerous tax proposal changes on the ballot during a period of Michigan's history, and this is the one that passed. I guess one of the things, and I'll say this charitably because it's probably also true, I'd rather imagine otherwise, but I don't think that our team is saying people are in all cases in the departments, in the actual administrations, trying to set every day and devise a way to harm local governments. We think this is, as it was said, it's a flawed implementation process at the least. But that flaw may not mean that somebody is in a dark room working on numbers with aha. It just simply has evolved in this crazy quilt work of different laws and regulations to put over the top of each other.
Well, we've been around long enough to know that all you need is the wrong interpretation initially, and we can sustain that for eternity. And that's something we're really good at, right? So somewhere along the way, that's the path they went down, and now steady as she goes. And this case is going to force people to sort of step back and say, was that the right path to go down in the first place? And I think as I look at this, And obviously I'm biased in my regard, but as you sort of try to take back, but it's pretty straightforward. Again, I keep coming back to this is the math we're discussing. When you sort of boil it down, it's pretty straightforward. The arguments are pretty straightforward. I'm going to be really interested to see as this progresses how they, if we don't prevail, and I'm surely hopeful that we do, what the arguments are that sort of undo that. Because it seems on the face of it, seems like what you guys have put forth makes a lot of sense.
Well, Tony, you've been speaking for the last year or more about the problems that have developed and have a lot of data with respect to how much municipal revenues have gone down, but at the same time, state revenues have gone up dramatically. So what may have been the case a number of years ago in terms of the state feeling during the recession that there were real state budgetary problems, is that the same today?
Well, I think the economic reality is different, but I think that the process which gets us in trouble in the first place, and we sort of danced around a minute ago, when they're making those final budget calls or they're figuring out how to interpret the Headley Amendment, guess who's not in the room? Nobody here.
Right.
And nobody in local government's in that room. And so you sort of can talk yourself into stuff. If we wanted to, the four of us, come up with something, we could talk ourselves into something that was really pro-local government, which may or may not be the right place to get to. That's what I think the real sort of hiccup in this process has been, is we're not really represented in that room when they're making those calls.
Okay, I was going to be good, but, you know, my good friend, Mr. Mathewson, said, you know, be careful on saying things about the state. And I will. I'll keep them clean. But I have to say this now that you, Tony, and Bill provoked me. So this is the same argument that has been made by the state for decades, that you people in local government should take care of your pensions. You don't know how to manage pensions. You need to change that. You people have to tighten the belt and work with, you know, more with less and onward. At the same time, the state of Michigan has done nothing that they say that we should do. There are less police officers and firefighters in Michigan, as I did not tell this group, but there are more state police that functionally one trooper could you equivalently could put 2.5 local police officers on the street for. You have a growth in state spending, as Bill mentioned. You have all these things, and then people who can't run their own government say to the local government, mayors, managers, and elected officials, you people should manage your pensions better, reduce your costs, and you know, provide for places of great learning and leadership for economic development on the cheap. While we do nothing, we talk a good game, we do not walk the walk.
Interesting little factoid: we have laid off more police officers at the local level than exist in the state police. Just a little fact for you. Parting thoughts, anybody?
Well, we want to say, I think, truly, as taxpayers for Michigan constitutional government, again, thanks for, and I want to say, as with John as a board director and officer, we thank everybody that's been supportive. As you said, this is not something we're not going to finish this with a commercial funded by some corporation or foundation. This is us. This is the real people, the real local people, and that is who we're hoping this change is for and to the benefit of, and for the principle of our Michigan Constitution. If the people vote on it, they should have some, we need to restore some semblance of belief that if you have a constitutional amendment you vote for, it will be implemented correctly.
Well said. Well, I appreciate you guys joining me today. It's been a really, really fun conversation. We set a new record for my longest podcast too, so I appreciate that as well. So, thanks for joining me.
We're just the guys to do it.
This has been a production of the Michigan Municipal League. For more information on our programs and services, please visit www.mml.org and join us for the next episode of We Love Where You Live.